Welcome to Medicus, a student-run podcast about any and all things in the world of medicine. Follow along as we interview outstanding individuals about important topics in healthcare.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Ari. I'm a new producer here at Medicus, and I am here with my friend Dan. Dan, if you wouldn't mind, could you introduce yourself to our listeners and maybe talk a little bit about, you know, what brings you here today?
Yeah, hey everyone. My name is Daniel Estrada. I'm an M2 at Stritch School of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. I guess I'm here to talk about being a non-traditional medical student and specifically coming from a military background.
Sure. Back it up a step if you don't mind. Where are you from?
So I was born in Medellin, Colombia, and I came to the States when I was young. My mother brought my sister and I when we were about 6, 7 to New York, actually. So I grew up in Queens, New York for the majority of my life before I left for college at Annapolis, Maryland, which is the U.S. Navy and Marine Corps Military Academy. So the big Army-Navy game that you guys see every year, the Navy team is the college football team for the Naval Academy. So did that for 4 years, graduated from the Naval Academy, commissioned as a officer in the Marine Corps, so a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps as a Marine, and then I went off to TBS, which they call the basic school. It's where every officer in the Marine Corps goes. We kind of learn, you know, basic infantry tactics and skills, learn how to lead a platoon, learn different officership skills that they kind of expect you to know in the Marine Corps. And then after that, I went to flight school. So down in Pensacola in Texas, did that for a few years, checked into my first squadron, was a pilot for a little bit. And then the latter half of my career in the military, I spent as a military advisor. So I did military advising for the last for 4 years of my career in Iraq, mostly.
Can you describe exactly what a military advisor does?
Not just in the Marine Corps, but military as a whole, even across the DOD and like State Department, the CIA, what they'll do is they'll send representatives from their respective organization that'll embed with the local military or their local counterparts. So the State Department will embed with, you know, governing organizations in Iraq. Us specifically, we embedded with the Iraqi army in Western Anbar, and we kind of helped them project military power against ISIS when ISIS was first becoming a thing. So that was around 2015. And so I spent the latter half of my career rotating through advising units, redeploying out to the Middle East, helping the Iraqis fight ISIS, essentially, and regain control of Iraq.
Wow, that's amazing. I think about myself being nervous one day to be a doctor and giving people advice on like blood pressure medication. Can only imagine, you know, working under that kind of pressure. Could we back it up a step just for a second? And you gave us a really cool timeline of your service in the military. What sparked your interest to join, you know, the Navy in the first place?
I grew up in New York City, and 9/11 happened when I was young. I was in eighth grade, I think. And then we kind of saw this big push to, you know, this big national pride to kind of, you know, take the war back to the people who that started with us. And I grew up seeing that. And it always kind of interested me. The idea of joining the military was always sort of an exotic adventure that, you know, every little boy, in my opinion, kind of dreams about having, right? But then as I was getting older and started high school, I had to think about what I wanted to do, you know, post high school, right? I couldn't stay at home forever. And, you know, we didn't grow up with a lot of money. I didn't have a lot of, you know, financial prospects in terms of being able to pay for college. So I figured joining the military was a good route for me, just to get me out of the house and kind of go on this big adventure that I kind of always wanted as a kid. But luckily for me, the recruiter that I went to was a Navy recruiter. And she saw my grades in high school, and she was like, look, you know, the United States military is looking for people that have good grades and that could represent the enlisted corps as officers. I think the Naval Academy is a really wonderful opportunity for you. And she kind of pushed me to take the exam and to take my SATs. I didn't do well, but luckily enough, I did well enough to where they offered me a spot at their prep school, the Naval Academy prep school in Rhode Island. So I did a year of prep school, and then it was a good deal because you just had to pass and then you would get in. So that's kind of what pushed me into the military. It was a desire to kind of get out of the house and to kind of, you know, live an adventure on your own.
Looking for an adventure, got out of your comfort zone. And it seems like, you know, the military really supported you with, you know, said a year of prep school. You know, obviously you went to the Naval Academy. Do they continue, you know, to this day to help support your journey to medicine in some capacity?
The Naval Academy as a whole, no, just because it's a four-year institution that's meant to produce officers. So I'm very much a part of the Alumni Association. I keep in touch with a lot of the classmates that I had while at the Naval Academy. But during my time in the military, as I was thinking about making that transition, I had a lot of senior officers that were very supportive of me making that transition. They gave me a little bit of time to go shadow physicians. During my time in Iraq, I got to shadow field surgical teams and kind of see the work that they did in a very, you know, austere environment, the kind of medicine that they provide in austere environments. And I thought, you know, that was a really wonderful way to give me some exposure and to kind of give me an idea of what medicine could be like for someone like me. With a military background. So the Naval Academy as itself wasn't supportive, but some of the leaders that I had working in the Marine Corps were definitely supportive of me kind of chasing this new chapter of my life.
Okay, so it sounds like, you know, the community itself is supportive. But beyond the Academy, you know, the actual entity of the Navy or the U.S. military more broadly, are they supportive in some capacity? I know undergrads have like a GI Bill. Is there something similar that allows people to transition from a significant career in the military like yours to other careers, particularly in medicine?
So if we're talking about medicine specifically, the one program, so I got out of the Marine Corps and I decided to get back into the military. So now I'm no longer a Marine. I'm still a Marine, but I'm not, you know, an active Marine. But I am considered now active Navy personnel. And that's because the United States Navy has a program for prior service members who want to go into the healthcare field. It's called HSCP. I forget what the acronym stands for. I think it's Health Specialties Collegiate Program. And it's a really pretty cool deal. It's really small. It's not very well advertised, but essentially, anybody who's prior service, and if they've been accepted to a healthcare professional graduate program, so like nurses, PAs, physicians, dentists. But what they do is they say, okay, wonderful, we're glad that you got accepted. We want and need that kind of support in the United States military. So what we'll do is we'll pay you to be an active duty component. So you'll be an active duty military member while in school. Your time towards retirement will continue to count, and you will get paid an active duty wage. And in return, you'll owe us 1 year for every year that we've paid you to essentially go to school. So, you know, I started that program after my first year of medical school. So I'll have 3 years under the HSCP program. And then once I get out, I'll owe 3 years back, whether that's in residency or whether that's residency time or med school time. And there's a whole, it gets a little more complicated than that, but that's essentially one program that I know the United States Navy in particular offers for prior service members going into a healthcare specialty. For people who weren't prior military, there are programs like HPSP, and they make that available to anybody who's in these graduate programs. And it's kind of the same deal. You serve for every 1 year of support that they give you. So they'll pay for your medical school, they'll pay for your dental school, or whatever it is. For every 1 year of support that they give you, you owe a year back in service.
That sounds really cool. I'm really happy to hear that the military goes out of its way, you know, to some degree to help people transition after their service. Are you obligated to, or do you need to do a military residency, or you're kind of free to do a non-military residency and do the service afterwards?
Yeah, so that's where it gets a little complicated and nuanced. It depends. So every year, whether you're Army, Navy, Air Force, every year there's X amount of spots for X specialty or for Y specialty in terms of residency slots, right? So primarily, you are required to attend a military residency. For example, let's just say general surgery. These numbers aren't real. I haven't looked at them, but we're just using this as an example. There are 10 residency spots every year for incoming general surgery residents. Only 10 people are going to be able to fill that spot across the United States. So individuals who are participating in the military match and want to go general surgery are all competing for 10 spots. If those 10 spots get full, then that's it. There's 10 spots. But this is where it gets a little complicated. Depending on the needs of the Navy, they forecast every year how many physicians they will need in that specialty. And so they will open up an X amount of civilian residency slots that people can apply to so that they can get their quota of said specialty. So if this year there's only 10 general surgery residencies available, but the Navy has, or the Army or whoever, has determined that they actually need 15 or 20, they'll allow 10 other people to match into general surgery, but they'll get what's called a civilian deferment, where they'll be able to get their general surgery residency outside of the military at a civilian establishment.
Okay, no, that's good. That's definitely a good amount of nuance for myself and our listeners. Sort of also going back to an earlier step, you obviously, with all of that service, come from a unique and an amazing background, but I didn't notice any time for like organic chemistry or physics or research. How did you go about preparing a med school application? And med school applications are a daunting process, and making time to fill out the secondaries and go for interviews. How did that work with your service? Did you take some sort of leave of absence? Was that accommodated?
Yeah, so that was something, like most people who apply to medical school, that's something that you really need to be able to forecast, right? Like, you have to understand what the process is to get into medical school, and then you have to take, you know, you have to go five steps back, figure out where you are and how you what you need to do to get to where you want to be. For me personally, I was able to, like, my active duty contract was up, was you know, coming closer, and I knew that in order to go to medical school, I had all these outstanding course requirements that I hadn't fulfilled, like organic chemistry, biochemistry, general chemistry. I took physics in college, but, you know, I got a C, right? So I had to redo all these things. And the best way that I found to be able to manage getting those prerequisites was to get out of the military, become a reserve military member, right? So I got out of the active component, became a reservist. And during my reserve time, like before I got out, I applied to a postdoc program in LA at Loyola Marymount University, which is a Jesuit school out in LA. They had a postdoc program for career changers. So I applied there prior to getting out. I got accepted, got out of the active duty component, transitioned to the reserve component. And so at that point, I was working part-time as a reservist and doing my coursework at the postdoc.
Okay. And then from there, you took the MCAT and an application. So it sounds like having an active military career isn't really an option, you know, in those gap years. But there are, you said you were able to shift over to reserve duty and make that work. That's really awesome.
Yeah. And I'd say if, you know, if there's any active military people listening to this for whatever reason, they definitely can kind of get those prerequisites prior to applying. You know, you just have to recognize that if you're in that kind of situation, you need to like ace all your grades or all your courses. You need to put yourself in the best position possible in order to get into medical school, because it's such a challenging task, right? So I found that it would be easier for me to, you know, concentrate on school for X amount of days, concentrate on work for X amount of days, and manage my schedule in that way to best get myself into medical school. But if you're an active duty member and you can take two classes a night over the course of a semester, ace those classes, and then take small little bits and pieces and explain why you had to do that once you apply to medical school, right? So it's definitely possible. It's just a little more difficult.
Thank you so much for explaining that to our listeners. you know, I hope maybe there's some amazing person out there in the military that just heard that and now is gonna live their dreams. Would you say there was a transition, and were there any difficult aspects to the transition from a military culture, a military lifestyle to, you know, med student or even post-bac student? Was there a culture shift, and how did you deal with that if there was?
Yeah, it was an incredibly big culture shift. So I had been deployed, we call it OCONUS, outside of the continental U.S., since 2015, off and on, most of the time abroad, right? So by the time I decided to get out and start my post-bac, you know, I had been gone from the continental U.S. for 4 or 5 years, right? So culturally, just as, you know, socially, things change in that amount of time, right? So, you know, getting out and kind of embedding myself into a more of a civilian culture was extremely challenging. You know, I remember in my bio 101 class, I had a girl sitting next to me and she was like, "This class is low key hard." And I just couldn't wrap my mind around what low key meant or where she was trying, like why the keyhole was low. It's silly, but you know, it's those kind of things that are just not, you're not used to hearing, you know, if you're abroad, right? The other aspect of it that was really challenging was, you know, I've been in uniform since I was 16, 17 years old when I left to prep school and then the Naval Academy. So the military in itself has its own little culture. It has its own, you know, social norms that people abide by. And when you kind of leave that in a very dramatic fashion to an undergraduate campus in Los Angeles, you know, 10, 15 years later, that entire thing, you know, that entire experience is especially challenging. I remember there was a young man who, you know, was throwing away some trash in the garbage and missed the trash, but didn't pick up the trash after. And of course, my Marine mind lost it. And I went and grabbed him. I was like, "Hey, you know, you think your mother's going to pick the stuff up for you? Go grab it." And he just looked at me like I was crazy. But it's one of those things where it's like I had to recognize that, like, I'm no longer on a Marine Corps base with military personnel, right? Like, I'm on a college campus with kids. And so that was difficult. And then just, like, the organizational culture is different, right? Like, healthcare, when I think about my time in medical school thus far, right? Like, people in healthcare, physicians, nurses, the way they think about the world is a little different than the way, you know, military people think about the world. That transition has been incredibly difficult because, you know, I've had 15 years of thinking in one way and in a dramatic fashion had to kind of shift the way I think, right? It's normal of most transitions, but it's still somewhat difficult.
Yeah, that's amazing perspective. I think one of the things that might sometimes get lost is that diversity of approaches to life, you know, approaches to thought and perspective, that kind of background, that kind of, you know, discipline that you don't just leave trash on the floor, that brings like a real amazing element to any community, obviously in its right context, but you know, that definitely brings a lot of amazing aspects to our community. And if I could be so bold as to speak on behalf of the medical system, medical world, I think that is truly something unique and amazing. As much as you're talking about the culture being different, I imagine perhaps the only type of organization that can give the military a run for its money on being complicated and having structures that aren't easily understood might just be healthcare. Do you think that sort of wading your way through dealing with various processes and trying to get things figured out and get things organized, do you think that might serve you well in a career as a physician? Obviously, at this point in our training, Dan and I are both M2s, and we haven't really had, you know, an hour-long hold with an insurance company trying to get a patient's MRI approved. But, you know, those stories are real. Being polite with people and knowing how to work on things and negotiate and get what you need through a system is a skill that I see being important in healthcare. And do you think that's something you've picked up in the military?
Any organization as big as healthcare or healthcare systems require a certain level of In Iraq, we call it wasta. Middle Easterns call it wasta. It's someone's ability to be able to influence others and manage themselves in a situation to get what it is that they need and to have pull in organizations. And so, do I think my career in the military has prepared me for that? I think I'll be less surprised by how slow bureaucracies move. You know, for me, the military is a slow, big beast that doesn't like to change. Even if in its most expeditionary form, the military can be very, very difficult to navigate in terms of getting like logistics or just even getting things approved, paperwork approved, administrative things approved. So I can't imagine that healthcare is going to be any different. But I think it's important to recognize that doesn't just exist in the military and at healthcare. That's just a characteristic of big organizations, and we're going to find that pretty much anywhere.
Aside from the dealing with big, slow organizations, do you think anything else in your background that comes to mind that might serve you well, either in medical school, in residency training, or as an attending physician?
Yeah, I mean, I think my time as an advisor was really helpful because it taught me a lot about how to interact with people, how to talk to people, how to get the most out of individuals who might not necessarily be on board at first. We were talking with people from different cultures who spoke different languages, who often, more often than not, didn't care about what the Americans had to say about what we wanted or how we wanted things done. So it was especially important for us to sort of acknowledge who they were, recognize that they are individuals within their own culture and have their own way of doing things, and be able to manage our expectations in a way that got the job done, right? So, and I think those skills will definitely help moving forward as a physician.
For sure. Speaking of your future as a physician, while you're still a little bit early on in your training, but have you any thoughts about specialties or something you might want to go into, and what's pointing you in that direction?
You know, I came into medical school thinking I wanted to become an orthopedic surgeon, and very quickly I realized that that's probably not the case. Right now I'm leaning on emergency medicine or general surgery. I want to practice medicine in an austere environment. I want to, because I'm back in the military, so I want to be able to, you know, practice wartime medicine. The Navy has what it's called wartime specialties, which include anesthesia, general surgery, ortho, emergency. Essentially what the United States Navy is trying to do is it's trying to sort of shrink its medical corps in size to provide wartime support to elements that are in like the Marine Corps or Navy elements or other, you know, Army elements that are forward deployed. And so I'm hoping to be able to match into one of those specialties because I feel like those would be most useful in that kind of environment.
Do you see long-term working with military service members and or veterans as part of your career or as a mainstay of your career at all?
You know, if I'm going to project into the future, you know, what I would like to see happen is I would like to, you know, finish my active duty time with the Navy, forward deployed. And then afterwards, I'd like to find myself in a position where I can continue to provide that austere environment medical support, either through organizations like Doctors Without Borders or Global Health Physicians. There are different organizations out there that put themselves in a situation where it's not the safest environment, but they're there to provide help for the indigenous people that are affected by climate issues, famine, hunger, disease, war. And so I think that would provide me the most sense of accomplishment, I think, as a physician. And so that's what I'd like to see for myself.
Amazing. It sounds like you don't have a specialty picked out, but you have a purpose. And that's, in a lot of ways, probably a lot more meaningful. Speaking to the broader audience of medical students, is there something that you wish that medical students would know about military service, or when they see somebody who's been in the military or who's actively in the military, something you wish they'd know or wouldn't necessarily occur to an average person walking around who hasn't served?
Yeah, recognize that people in the military, just like anyone else, like we have our, you know, we're really proud of our service. We're proud of the things that we've done for our country. And, you know, maybe some of the younger generations or whoever out there doesn't necessarily think that is owed a certain amount of respect. I think just recognizing that there are people that dedicate their lives in service of something that's a little bigger than themselves, and that actually parallels medicine very well, right? So I think just having that recognition of, you know, selflessness through service is important, and being able to I guess at least appreciate that in a service member.
Fantastic. Once upon a time, I volunteered in a clinic with a former service member. And I think the first time I met the guy, I said this cheesy line that I think everyone says, you know, thank you for your service. And he says back to me, thanks for paying your taxes.
Yeah.
and I just took a second and I'm like, if that's the deal, that he, you know, was deployed and all I had to do was pay my taxes every April, I am so glad to be thankful. Moving so a little bit beyond, you know, active duty service members, much of our audience might not know Loyola University Medical Center is back to back, quite literally adjacent properties with one of the largest VA hospitals in the country. And Loyola students specifically have many opportunities to interact with veterans. Being in sort of a unique position or having a unique perspective, do you have any general advice on how student doctors and physicians as well can interact appropriately and deliver quality care to people who've devoted themselves to service? Some of them have made, you know, major sacrifices so we can live the lives we do. And, you know, how can we best relate to that population? What can we do to serve them best?
Yeah, I think it's a function of just understanding who you're seeing, right? Like, you know, prior to going seeing a patient for a case, you're going to do some research on the case, right, medically, and you're going to find out who you're seeing, what you're treating them for. But there's this other aspect of it that you should probably consider, which is who is the individual that's coming to see me, and where are they from? And part of that, I think, is, you know, asking and listening to their story. You know, if they're in the Navy, you know, maybe just having some familiarity with what was going on with his or her particular service branch when he was in the military, or just listening, because a lot of the time those guys just want to share their stories. They just want to, you know, they're at a time of reflection of their lives, and not everybody has the time to hear them, right? We're all so busy. We're all moving around at a million miles an hour. And a lot of those guys are, you know, at a point where they don't, you know, they have some time and they want to share their stories. They want to share it with somebody, because not every single one of them has, you know, family support. Not every single one of them has a social support circle where they can kind of release some of these stories into the world. So I'd say just knowing who you're going to talk to, have an appreciation for what the military has done over the course of the years so that you can actually have a decent conversation with them about their time in service, and just actually listening.
Okay, take that a step further. So if I've done a little bit of research and maybe I know what years a particular patient served, and I can sort of put that together with Korea or Vietnam or Afghanistan or Iraq, is there a way to broach the topic of someone's military service during a medical visit that's appropriate and comfortable for the patient? I'm still nervous about talking about blood pressure medications. Learning how to talk about probably some of the best and some of the worst times in a lot of these people's lives. Any advice for how and maybe when to even broach that topic?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a tough thing to answer, because I think every situation is going to be very much dependent on the service member themselves or how they're feeling, what they're in for, right? But I think, you know, generally asking what branch of service they were, when they served, where they served, maybe asking a particular time that they really enjoyed their service or what about their service that they actually appreciated, and taking the conversation from there, I think is generally a safe way to approach that topic. A lot of the veterans that you talk to definitely want to share their stories if they're up for it. And so I'd say just, you know, listening and asking questions about, you know, how they felt about the situations they were in, or like, you know, was there any really fun times that they had, or some challenging times? Maybe if you feel like the situation is, the conversation is open to that kind of conversation. So I don't think there is a right answer to that question. I think it very much sort of depends on the service member themselves and what kind of information they're giving you. These kind of conversations need to be taken with tact, right? Like, you need to be able to read the room and understand whether or not this individual is even open to having a conversation with you. And that conversation starts with, hey, what branch of service did you serve in? And can you tell me a little bit more about your time in the military? Are there any particular moments that you enjoyed? And then if you feel like that conversation is kind of opening up, you know, you could say, hey, I noticed this tattoo on your arm. Does it have any significance to your time in service? And then you can see, like, if they want to talk about it, they'll talk about it. They'll be more than happy to kind of open up about it. And if they, you know, and if they don't want to, they'll definitely just, they'll shut you down. But, you know, it's one of those things you just got to read. You got to read the person, read the room.
You mentioned that a lot of veterans have difficulty, you know, finding resources or finding people just to spend time with them. And, you know, they could really use a support system. Are there any nonprofits or charities that you know of that do high quality work with veterans? To hear it from somebody who's from the military community, that there's one that you're comfortable with, I think that might point some of our listeners in a good direction.
There's one in particular. It's called PB Abate. It's Patrol Base Abate. It was started by a Marine officer who was deployed to Afghanistan. I think he deployed a few times, but essentially he's still in active duty. I think he's the operations officer of 3-5 out in Pendleton at the moment. But this organization is very supportive of the military community, especially Marines. They do their best to kind of integrate service members who've gotten out with other individuals and other organizations to kind of help them transition. Like anybody who's having trouble in the civilian life or maybe has a little bit of issues transitioning. It's definitely an organization that people can connect with and get support if they needed it.
Okay, thank you so much for sharing that with us. The Medicus staff will be making a small donation to PB Abate in your honor, and we really appreciate your time. Our friend Daniel Estrada, thank you so much for joining us, and wish everyone the best.
Thanks for listening to this episode. This wouldn't be possible without the support from our listeners. Please rate, review, and subscribe. We appreciate donations to help fund the production of this podcast. To support us, go to medicuspodcast.com, where you can additionally find show notes, links, and information about our guests. We are at Medicus Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. If you have any questions, comments, or episode suggestions, please submit them on our website. This podcast is intended for general information purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine. No patient-doctor relation is formed, and the content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Views and opinions are their own and do not represent any organization.